Genesis chapter 37, we kind of close the scene on Jacob and end our look at him. To be honest with you, a miserable look from what we've discovered, and a miserable life. Sometimes people are reckoned as heroes, and when you consider their lives a little more closely, you realize I wouldn't want to live that kind of life. And we move on to the study of Joseph, which brings us really kind of in an interesting circle as we consider the patriarchs, and we've been studying these characters now for quite some time. But as we begin with Abraham, who was, of course, the father of the Jewish people, we looked at an individual who left all that he had. God isolated him and separated him, first of all, from his land and from his economy and his culture, and moved him out into the barrenness, really, of the unknown. And it's water, trust me, okay? At my request. It's ice water, too. I guess that's ice floating in there. God moved him away from all that he knew. Shut him up. Made him experience loneliness. And never done a complete study on it. But there is benefit to loneliness. And you'll see it. We're fixing to see it for the second time. There's a danger sometimes that if you and I are not careful of, we'll have to deal with, called second and third generation Christianity. I have said to you many times, the fact that you got saved is a wonderful thing, but you had better live your life so as to influence your grandchildren for Jesus Christ. There is a tragedy that befalls many Christian families that get saved, fall in love with Jesus Christ, live for the Lord, and try their best to raise their children to love the Lord. And that circumstance happens to be the loss of their family. Not in the sense of dying, but in the sense of not serving the Lord. There just doesn't seem to be the passion there for God that was in mom and dad. And you say, explain it to me. I can't explain it to you. Nor can I say there is a key by which you'll be guaranteed not to have to endure that. I sometimes see people and they say, well, you know, we're doing this to ensure that won't happen. You better be very careful, because there is no guarantee. And I wish I could tell you that there was a secret, and if you did things a certain way, that you would be assured of success. But I'll be honest with you, some things that I have seen. I preached several months ago now, it's been, on how to raise one of America's 10 most wanted. I can't tell you how to raise a good kid. I can tell you how to raise a bad kid. And I wish I could tell you how to raise a good kid. I wish I could give you those guarantees, but they're not there. But one of the things that I see is a desire, a passion for God. And if it is not there, it does not make any difference at all what environment you raise a child in. If there is not a passion for God, if there is not a passion for the Word of God, if there is not a passion for the church, you'll ruin your children. And I say that because of the limited experience that I have. I sit back and I see those who have lost their children. And those are the characteristics that I find again and again and again. It is not always a mom and dad that didn't care anything about God. As a matter of fact, I've known a number of preachers to lose their families. Men who had a passion for God, but somehow they failed to instill that passion for God in the lives of their children. They were so busy with the things of God that they did not instill that passion for God or that love for God in the lives of their children. I'm going to be honest with you. One of the ways I see that taking place in a number of times is the fact that we murmur and complain against God at nearly every turn. And there's a great danger in that. I say we murmur against God when we talk about, God didn't do this and He didn't do that. And I don't know what the Lord's doing in my life. You know, I don't know why we can't get a better job. I don't know why we can't live in a better house. I don't know why we have to live this kind of lifestyle. I don't know why, and then throw it at the feet of God. And I'm going to be honest with you. You'll defeat a child in the very beginning when you begin to discuss such matters in such a way as to throw the blame at God's feet. I'm going to tell you something. There's nothing in your life that can be blamed on God. And you say, well, God's allowing it to happen. Yeah, He is. He's either trying to teach you something or undo something you think you know. But God is dealing with you, and the blame is always right here. Anything that goes right or wrong in my life, I mean, the blame is here if it goes wrong. If it's right, it's the mercy of God. You can count on that every time. But sometimes, if we're not careful, we will take a child and raise a child in a sheltered environment. And you say, well, that's the key. No, it's not the key at all. A sheltered environment does not produce a passion for God. Nor does a worldly environment produce a passion for God. I wish I could tell you how to produce a passion for God. I know sometimes parents tend to cast off on God when it comes to the things of God, the work of God. Not just how God treats you in your personal life. But when it comes to things like reading your Bible, witnessing, and being faithful to the church. We hear people say, well, you know, I just... Be careful, because that passion in your child for God is easily destroyed. And sometimes it could be nothing more than, well, I just don't want to teach my Sunday school class, or I just don't want to get involved with this Bible reading thing again, or I don't have enough time to read my Bible. You'd be amazed at how little it can take to undo the passion or to destroy the passion you want to create in your child for God. I find sometimes people don't place an importance on church. They don't place, it's an amazing thing, they don't place importance on church till they lose their kid. And then they want the church to take the blame or else straighten out the situation. There is a danger that we not create or kindle or encourage that passion for God. And I say again, I'm kind of in no man's land here. I don't have any pat answers. I don't have any solid answers. But I know this, if a child doesn't have a heart for God, there is nothing you can do as far as the environment. You put them in a Bible college and pay their way through a Bible college, and you'll raise a heathen in a Bible college. I know enough about Bible college to know that to be so. I sat next to some guys who were heathen. I had some Bible college students show up on my front porch drunk as a skunk. You say, what was it? Were they raised in a bad home? No, they were raised in a good home. The difference was they didn't have a passion for God that could restrain them from the temptations in this world. And you better be cautious. You better be cautious. I say that because notice, if you will, one of the key factors, I think, in Abraham's life and his godliness was his loneliness. Not isolated from the things of the world, but loneliness. In the sense that he had nobody else but God. And if I can teach anything to you, or if I teach anything to my children that I want you to see, I think we need to teach our children that God is what they need to come to depend on in their life. Sometimes God just becomes that big fancy guy up in the sky, you know, and isn't he great and isn't he wonderful? We need to teach our children God is all you've got and he's all you need. That passion needs to be there in the lives of our children. My wife and I have talked, we've tried as we raised our children. There were difficult times in pastoring a church. I know you may not believe that, but there are occasionally times you'd like to just blow somebody away. And there were times when, you know, the best way to talk about it is get in the car on the way home. You know, it's a long drive home. And it's quiet. And we've had to check ourselves because of the fact that I don't want my children to grow up with a bad taste for church because of what I talked about in front of my kids. I visited a fellow not long after I came here and began to pastor this church. Actually, a little bit north of here. But I knocked on his door one day, and he invited me in, and I started to tell him about Jesus Christ, and he said, hold it. He said, I was raised in a Baptist preacher's home. He said, my dad was a Baptist preacher. And I said, well, great. I said, well, do you go to church? He said, no, I don't go to church at all. And I said, well, I want to invite you to come to our church. He said, I won't be coming. And I said, why not? He said, I'll never go to church again as long as I live. He said, I saw how Christian people treated my mother and father. And he said, I wouldn't go to church if my life depended on it. Well, I'm not going to blame it on the church. I'm going to blame it on mom and dad. A mom and dad that allowed that to influence the life of their child. And I'm going to tell you something right now. It wasn't just how the church treated him. It was the attitude with which they responded. Now, you take somebody, anybody can take bad times and not let it be an adverse effect in the lives of their children. It's how you handle those bad times. And so I blame that on mother and father. I don't want that in the life of my children. I don't want my children to grow up and say, well, you know, yeah, you know this about church, but I know this and I know this and I saw this and I saw that and I just don't want any part of it. I don't want that. So there needs to be some loneliness, not necessarily isolation. Notice, if you will, Abraham is alone, but he is not isolated. Abraham is living when God calls him out of Ur of the Chaldees and brings him into the land of promise. Is he living in a godly environment? No, he's living in a very ungodly environment. But the key was that Abraham was alone with God. He was not isolated with God. He was alone with God. And his loneliness instilled within him a godliness, so much so that God himself referred to Abraham as his friend. Then comes Isaac into the picture. Abraham, alone and godly. Isaac. And in Isaac, we don't see any sinfulness. We don't see any shortcomings, so to speak. But we don't see any fervor. We don't see any fever in this guy. We don't see that passion in the life of Isaac. As a matter of fact, we pointed out to you, I think there's only one chapter in all of Genesis that deals with Isaac. He's kind of a nobody. And certainly he's one of the heroes of the Jewish people. But there's no passion there. What does Isaac do for God? What great accomplishment does he have in his life for God? Nothing. Second generation Christian. Raised in a sheltered environment while his father was alone with God. Isaac was isolated. Isaac didn't have the passion for God. And while he was alone from the world, or isolated from the world, he also was isolated from God because the passion wasn't there that his father had for God. And I see in the life of Isaac, as we've already dealt with him, dedication. But dedication not to God, but dedication to a code that he'd been taught by his father. Dedication to his father's ideals, if you will. A good son. A submissive son. An obedient son. But no passion for God. I don't want to raise a kid like that. Be a danger, a tragedy to raise a child like that. And yet Isaac comes along, I see him as dedicated but pampered. Pampered and kept aloof from those things and no passion for God. You say, well, he did all right. Yeah, he did all right, but look at what he raised. You never determine somebody's character until you look at what they raise. And here comes his offspring, Jacob. What is Jacob? Jacob is worldly and Jacob is selfish. Was Jacob raised in a Christian home? Yeah. Raised with ideals, godly ideals? Yeah. What happened? You see the third generation, what you're dealing with here? Here is an old man, Abraham, who is alone and he is struggling and he is seeking. He has a passion for God. He wants to know God. He wants to walk with God. And he gives birth to a child that follows along in dad's footsteps. But there's no passion there. And look at Abraham's grandchildren. Abraham's grandchildren threatening to kill each other, deceiving their father, lying to people, cheating, stealing. We came through here and studied Jacob, and to be honest with you, Esau is the more godly of the two in his character. And he's usually the one that gets the brunt of the discouraging remarks made about him. And I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I just see this again and again and again. The man that God uses, he isolates. You take Elijah over there working for God. You know what Elijah said? He said, I alone am left. Nobody else but me. You watch that feeling of loneliness. And somewhere along the way, there is a passion for God that even when the loneliness comes, it says, David said, whom have I on earth but thee? Loneliness. Loneliness. Was David a lonely man? David was thronged with people. But somehow, his being alone out there on the backside of the wilderness in Judea, and a cultivation in his life of a desire or a passion for God, even later on, when thronged by the masses, he was alone. Jesus Christ, alone. Alone. Paul, alone. You watch that thing over and over and over again. You may tell you what you might ought to work on teaching your children? How to be alone. Not isolated, but alone. How to be alone with God. Cultivate that passion for God. Now watch what God does. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're going right down the line, getting worse all the time. So Jacob shows up. You know, Jacob is an unusual character in several senses. First of all, over a quarter of the book of Genesis deals with his life. More than anybody else. A quarter of this book is going to deal with this young man's life. You say, well, why is that interesting? It's interesting because he's not even in the Messianic line. I mean, you'd think, everybody says, well, when you're studying the Bible, you're studying Jesus Christ right from the book of Genesis. And when you come down through there, you're... Do you know that Joseph is not one of Jesus Christ's descendants? Jesus Christ comes from he's the line of the tribe of Judah. Joseph has two sons, and their tribes are Ephraim and Manasseh. And yet a quarter of this book deals with the life of this young man. Secondly, he is unusual in the fact that he is alone. But more than that, he is the greatest type of Jesus Christ in all the Old Testament. There is no greater type of Christ anywhere in the Old Testament than Joseph is. We're going to spend some time looking at him over the next several weeks. And I think there is over 140, if I'm not mistaken, 140 particular places where Joseph is a type or a picture of Jesus Christ that is to follow. Now, how do you get a young man like that? Notice, if you will, what kind of father he had. It's not. It's not in the parents that you got. You know what God does to Joseph? He's alone. And he's godly. He's alone and he's godly. Right back to where Abraham started. God said to Abraham, get thee out of the land of thy father, the land of thy kindred, and the land that I'll show thee of. And Abraham does by faith what Joseph has to do by force. But Joseph gets him out of the land of his father and out of the land of his kindred into a land that God kind of dumped him in. Do you know what one of the greatest character building tools there is? Adversity. Nothing builds character like adversity. You say, I don't believe it. Why do you think God lets you have so much adversity in your life as a Christian? Why do you think God lets you encounter the things you encounter? Because adversity builds character. Because adversity makes you alone. We've got a new society coming up with new ideals and new traits. Somebody sent me a copy of testing, a question, sample question. It goes all the way back to, you know, the early days of testing. And it was, you know, so-and-so cuts down so many feet of lumber and his profit margin is such a percentage. Give us the equation. 15, 20 years later, it was so-and-so cuts down so many trees, A, and his profit margin is B. How much did he make? Multiply A times B. Then back in the 70s, the question was, so-and-so cuts down so many trees and he makes so many dollars. His profit margin was 20%. Circle 20 on your paper. And then in this generation, the statement was, some uncaring fool goes out into the woods and cuts down trees for a mere $20 profit, write an essay on the environmental hazards and the danger imposed upon society by this man's actions. That's today's attitude. And attitudes have changed. We're dealing in a society that says, well, we don't want adversity. We want everybody to have something. We don't want anybody to be raised in poverty. Some of the greatest men this country ever turned out were men raised in poverty. Well, we don't want anybody raised in a situation. We don't want them to be homeless. Great men have grown up homeless. Well, you know, everybody needs this, everybody needs that, everybody needs a fair share, everybody needs a fair cut of the pie. You say, well, it's easy for you to talk because you had a fair, and I thank God I did. I never went hungry in my life. I never knew what it was to sleep without a roof over my head unless it was by my own choice or design. I'm thankful I didn't have to go that route. I will be honest with you. Just raising somebody in the best environment does not provide character. And what little character I might have, I did not get because of the environment I was raised in. I got it from seeing a passion for God in the lives of people around me so much so that I wanted it in my life. Not just my parents. I realize at this point, to be honest with you, my heroes are my parents. But I realize that I can think back to at least 4 or 5 Christian Sunday school teachers that had as much of an impact in my life for God as my parents did. As a matter of fact, at a time when I rejected my parents, remember that time when you were growing up? It's called adolescence. See, I know we're going to raise a child so when they get to be an adolescent, we're not going to have any trouble with them. Don't hold your breath. At a time when I rejected my parents as credible influences in my life, there were some men that stepped to the plate and filled a gap in my life. And I would not have ever been in the ministry had it not been for some of those men in my life. They had a passion for God that I saw, not just in mom and dad. Listen, mom and dad, there's going to come a time when your kids are not going to care what's in your life. And you say, oh, it won't happen to me. Just wait and see. Well, it'd be tragic to wait and see, but some of you may have to wait and see. Your children are going to reject you. Don't you see? You represent that authority figure, and when they begin to rebel against authority, you're going to be the first one they rebel against. You'd better make sure you've got a system of individuals who can step up to the plate and take your place when they're not listening to you. When your children quit listening for your advice, who are they going to turn to for advice? That's where we get in trouble, isn't it? I don't know of any kids that went bad because mom and dad gave them bad advice. As a matter of fact, as I said before, I've seen some good parents have some problems with their children. But you see, the situation was such a situation so that when the kids rejected the parents' advice, they turned to the wrong place to get advice. I'm thankful that God put me in a position where I was surrounded by people that had a passion and a love for God. And I saw it not just in my father's life, not just in my mother's life, but I saw it in this one's life, and in this one's life, and in this one's life, and in this one's life. And all at once I realized how alone I was. You know what adolescence is? It's a time of loneliness, isn't it? I think sometimes we've looked at this thing of adolescence in the wrong way. Somebody maybe needs to write a new book. What a chance to raise or develop a child with a love for God. Do you remember when you became a teenager? Don't you remember when you felt alone? How many of you felt alone when you got to be a teenager? I don't care who you are. One of the feelings that goes with adolescence is loneliness. Hey, what did we just say about Abraham? He was alone and godly. What do we find out about Joseph? Alone and godly. Elijah, alone. Jesus Christ, alone. Paul, alone. Loneliness can be beneficial if it generates that passion for God. God puts Joseph into a situation of adversity. And that adversity made him the character that he was. I don't know that there was ever a greater hero in the nation of Israel than Joseph. He does not get all the credit. He is not proclaimed as the greatest. But when you look at his deeds and you look at what he had to overcome to accomplish what he accomplished. Now, I realize, listen, I realize Moses brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. But Moses was raised in Pharaoh's palace. He didn't have a lot of difficulties to overcome. Joseph did. And it was adversity that God used to mold him. It's interesting as we read through chapter 37 here tonight, just for a few minutes. All the good things that happened to Joseph while he was growing up. He was raised in a warm home environment with all the kindness of siblings and love, brother and sister love that they had there in the home. Just a wonderful environment to raise a character. So good of an environment that God said, I got to get him out of here. This kid will grow up a heathen. What a wonderful environment. Notice, if you will, in verse number 4, when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him. Look at verse number 5. Joseph told a dream, dreamed a dream, told it to his brethren, and they hated him. Look at verse number 8. His brethren said unto him, shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him. And verse number 11. And his brethren envied him. Verse number 18, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. Isn't it wonderful when brothers love each other like this? What a wonderful home life he had. He was raised in the best of care. Matter of fact, look, the only reason they spared him. Now, I was reading this today. I read a commentator said, you know, Judah spared his brother because he didn't want to see him get killed. But I went over here and read what Judah said. Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother? Key word, profit. Next verse, let's sell him. Oh, yeah, Judah was a great brother. Kept him alive, thought he'd make a little cash on the side. Look at next verse 26 and 27. What profit is it if we slay our brother? Come and let us sell him unto the Ishmaelites. Let's make a little money on this guy. Hey, they'll kill him for us. We won't feel guilty. We'll make a few bucks on the side. Don't you wish you had brothers and sisters like that? What a loving home he had. Wonderful environment. Environment of hatred. A carnal father. A boy growing up deprived of his mother, probably early in his teen years, but growing up with three stepmothers, growing up in the home we just looked at last week. Some Christian homes will destroy a child. Verse number 1, Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. This is interesting. He said, these are the generations of Jacob, and then he doesn't give it. He goes right to Joseph. Joseph is the apple of his father's eye. And we pointed out to you last week, the fact that Jacob made some tragic mistakes along the way. Joseph is born of his mother and he comes along late in life. He is the child of his old age. And yet Joseph is the paramount of all there is. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. The lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Now, he's with his brothers, but he's not with his brothers. Notice it's categorized here. The sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. It didn't say he was with his brethren. It said he's with these sons. There, you know, the old statement is, blood is thicker than water. And while Joseph had the same father, he did not have the same mother. And Joseph is out there running around with these boys. The life of a shepherd is a very, very difficult life. We see the picture, you know, with the old sheepdog and the guy with the crooked little cane, you know, in some pastoral setting. And we think, boy, isn't it wonderful? But the life of a shepherd, particularly in these times, in biblical times, was probably one of the most difficult of all that there was. Could be compared perhaps to our early American cowboys. Not the kind you see today, you know, the dime store type. But the kind that actually slept out on the ground 360 days out of the year. And slept under the snow and in the rain and sat in the saddle all night long and took care of the cattle and lived a very hard and harsh life. That is what the life of a shepherd is like. These are not wimpy boys. These are strong men that have a difficult job to do. And here's Joseph. Now, I say here's Joseph because Joseph's 17. How many of you remember when you were 17? Need I say more? And here comes this 17-year-old snotty-nosed kid out here. And remember, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah are all much older than he is. We're talking 35, 40 years of age, some of these fellows. And Joseph comes out. What's one thing you know about a 17-year-old? What does a 17-year-old know? See? Unanimous vote. A 17-year-old knows everything. So here comes a 17-year-old out here to help these 40, 35-year-old shepherds take care of their flocks. Do you see the situation? Not a friendly atmosphere at all. Especially when he shows up wearing his new coat. His coat of many colors. And the implication is it's great value and preciousness because nobody got coats. In order to get a coat of many colors, you had to have many types of yarn, many colors of yarn. Many hours of work went into a coat like this. The difference between, you know, just a regular old Wrangler jean jacket and, you know, some Sergio Valente something or other. He shows up in a fine coat. Made specially for him. Some say that the term coat means it was a long thing, flowed all the way to his feet, not for doing hard work in. So Joseph shows up purely in an advisory capacity, I'm sure. And he's got his three-piece vested on, and the other guys out here with dirt under their fingernails and a little body odor, you know, and haven't changed clothes in a week or so. And here comes Joseph in his new duds. And doesn't help the situation when he tells them that Dad had it made just for him because they're already aware of the fact that Joseph has his dad's eye. And Joseph is the favorite. The Bible said they hated him because they saw that his father loved him more. It is difficult to raise a family with impartiality. If you have children, you know what I'm saying. You say, well, you can't love one more, but you love every one of them more in some capacity. And if you try to hide that, the worst thing I believe is to conceal that. You're going to have a child that perhaps is funny, and you're going to love them for their sense of humor. You're going to have a child that perhaps is talkative and cheerful and full of life, and you're going to love them for that. You're going to have another child that may be talented. Maybe they can draw or write or do something. You're going to love them for that. And in each of those characteristics, you're going to love that child more than the others in that particular area. Sometimes parents say, well, I could never show that to my child. I think it's much more dangerous to conceal it. But there better be something you love about every one of your children. Joseph is loved more than all the other brethren, and they see it. And they hated him. Notice the depth of their hatred. They could not speak peaceably unto him. Some of you live there. When siblings hate one another so desperately that they can't speak peaceably to somebody, you've got problems. And here is something that Jacob should have dealt with. But he doesn't. Probably owing to his carnality. But he grows up in an environment. Notice he is isolated from his brethren. They hate him because of his father's love. The type of Jesus Christ. You know who the Jews despise? They despise Jesus Christ. You know why? Because of the Father's love. Notice, if you will, they despise him in verse number 5, or they hate him. Joseph dreamed a dream. They hate him for his vision. He has a vision and sees in the dream the sheaves of wheat and all those things that pertain to that. And they hate him because he is a dreamer. And we tend to think of the dreamer in the term of slacker in this day and time. And Joseph's life tells us anything, tells us he was not a slacker. He was not an individual like to stretch out in a hammock and daydream. He's not a daydreamer. His dreams here have the same idea behind them as someone who invents, or their mind is continually occupied. Now his mind is on things of God, and God is revealing things to him. We think of him as a daydreamer. This is not a daydreamer. This is the kid that's hard at work. He is preoccupied, if you will. His mind is always going, and he is dreaming. His mind's active. They hate him because he dreams a dream. Then notice, if you will, they hate him because of his prophesied authority. He saw all the sheaves and he said, "Your sheep bows down to my sheep and does homage," and they get a little irritated with that. I mean, after all, they're all older than he is. Some of them undoubtedly have families and children. Some of them may indeed have children that are older than Joseph. And so Joseph waltzes into the picture and says, "Guess what? I got it all figured out. God showed me a dream the other night. And in my dream, God said, I get to be the honcho and you guys have to bow down and worship me." I'm sure he didn't say it quite like that. It probably was worse. Remember, he's a young man. And they hate him all the more. Now you say, why is this going on? God is separating Joseph and making him alone. Do you ever wonder why Joseph asked so much for Benjamin when they finally get down into Egypt? Because Benjamin's the only brother he's got. And without Benjamin all these years, he's been alone. He's had a loneliness that Judah never had to put up with, that Reuben never had to put up with, that Simeon never had to put up with, that Levi, that Dan, that Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. None of those boys had to put up with being alone. But Joseph is alone. And when his brother Benjamin is born, Joseph is carried away so he can continue to be alone. Something about loneliness that God can work in. Parents, you better instill in your children the fact that when you find yourself all alone, and when you feel that there's no one around that cares anything about you, there is still one. And he is always there. And he always cares. Joseph got alone. God is allowing him to be separated from what should normally be a situation of love. And God moves him away from that. Notice, if you will, verse number 11. He comes to his father and tells the dream, the second dream that he had, about the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars making obeisance to him. Now think for a minute. There are 12 boys. And the sun and the moon would be mom and dad and the brethren doing obeisance to him. Well, his father didn't even like this. His father kind of rebukes him in verse number 10 and says, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth?" Is that what's going to happen? Is that what you're saying? His father understood it. and his brethren envied him. Now notice, if you will, here's a guy that is left alone. His brethren hate him. But then their hatred turns to envy. And their envy soon turns to conspiracy. When you run into somebody that's envious of somebody else, you better stay clear of them. Because generally, you're going to be dealing with hatred and conspiracy and perhaps murder before it's all over with. Or at least character assassination. Envy is a dangerous, dangerous characteristic of life. And yet people are eat up with it in this society. His brethren envied him. Now, they hated him. But notice, if you will, the more they separated him and the more he was alone, the more he's getting from God. You see that? They hate him. They don't want him around. And God gives him a dream. And the more he becomes alone, the more his passion, I believe, grows for God. The more God deals with him, the more he knows. And the more he knows, the more they hate him. And finally, they're envying him. And he goes looking for them. Verse 12, 13, Shechem and Dothan. It was a long way from home. Dothan is in Alabama. He goes looking in Shechem and they tell him he's not there and send him to Dothan. Dothan's where Bob Jones Sr. was born. Born and raised, Dothan, Alabama. And not the Dothan that's here. I'm being sarcastic. I hope you understand that. He goes looking and can't find him. Somebody gives him directions and here he goes wandering down to Dothan. Just typical teenager. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, evidently he's out there lost wandering around and hadn't even seen him yet. They conspired against him to slay him. And notice what they call him. Behold the dreamer. You can always tell what somebody's envious about, what they call you. Amen. It's got a way of showing up. Walk down the hall, somebody says, yeah, here comes Mr. Soul Winner. I'll tell you what they're envious of. Here comes the Bible scholar. Always has a way of showing up, doesn't it? Here comes mommy's favorite. You find out immediately what they envy if you listen to the way they talk. They're envious of Joseph because God is giving something to Joseph that they're not getting. They've been raised in the same semblance of godliness in their home. The same godly characteristics that Joseph has been taught, they've been taught. As a matter of fact, I believe in the case of Leah's children, even more so. And it's interesting to note, Leah's children aren't even mentioned here. I know that Rachel was a heathen. She had the idols, the gods. Only the Lord knows what she might have tried to teach Joseph, just the grace of God, that he turns out like he does. But these other boys have been taught these same principles. They've known their father. They've seen his way of life. They've seen his manner of activity. They were there the night that the angel of God wrestled with him and they've seen him walk with a limp ever since. And for some reason, they're envious of Joseph because Joseph's got a little bit closer walk with the Lord than they do. People are going to envy you and they're going to hate you if you get close. Something about it, people always tend to love people that are a little further below them on the spiritual ladder and hate anybody that's a little higher up. It's envy. And they conspire to slay. And they say, behold, this dreamer comes. Well, there's what they're envious of right there. The boy's got something from God they don't have. Now notice, if you will, Leah's children are here. Here's Reuben. Reuben heard it and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. One of Leah's boys. And you get out here to Judah, and I said before, Judah looks to me like he's trying to make a little money. But probably at heart, he's got a desire to keep him from getting killed. He said, don't shed any blood. That's one of Leah's boys. And so they bring him up out of the pit and they sell him to a bunch of Midianites. And the Midianites are headed off down into Egypt to sell their goods in the land of Egypt. And they bid him farewell and he's gone. Now, notice, if you will, Joseph's attitude in all this. What does Joseph say about it? Nothing. You don't hear Joseph saying a word. He has, for some reason, not got anything to say about it. Now, if that was you that was down in the pit, number one, everybody would know you were down in the pit. Because it'd be like one of them big, you know, horns there, woofers and tweeters, and your voice would be heard all over the wilderness, hollering, get me out of here. But you don't hear anything. As a matter of fact, I know he was quiet because Reuben, who had intended to liberate him, didn't even know what was going on. And regrets later on the fact that he hadn't been there. He doesn't say anything, as far as we know, to the Midianites. He doesn't say anything when they take him down into Egypt. He's a type of Christ. The Bible said, as a sheep is dumb before a shearer, so he openeth not his mouth. He voluntarily, willingly submits to this. You know, think about what an unusual character you're dealing with here. Here is a young boy who at 17 begins to get isolated from his brethren. He's alone in the sense he has no brother. His brother is born. He's gone. He's alone in the sense that his other brethren, his half-brethren, hate him. He's alone in the sense that he gets things from God that no one else is getting. God is giving him a dream. God's giving him a vision that no one else is having a part of. He's alone in the sense that he's hated of all his brethren. And you don't hear him saying anything about it. Do you know we like to be hated because it gives us something to talk about? How many times have we started our testimony with, well, I just thank the Lord, but you know, these people, that they just hated me and they did me wrong and they cheated and they lied, but God helped me out. If they hadn't cheated us and lied to us and stuff, then we wouldn't have anything to talk about. Somehow we think, you know, that just magnifies God and His glory and His grace if we talk about how bad people have treated us. Joseph doesn't have anything to say about it. Which brings me to my next point. The man who is alone with God, has a passion for God, is number one, going to be hated. But number two, he is not going to be angry about any situation or circumstance God puts him in. You know, you don't find Joseph complaining for the next 30 some odd years of his life. And there's not a person in this auditorium tonight that would want to trade places with him. Oh, we'd all like to trade places with him when he gets into Pharaoh's palace. Second to kingdom. We can handle that. Little Lamborghini, you know. Drive through the streets there. We can handle that. But not a one of us would want to say, hey, here he is. He's going down into Egypt's land. That's where I want to join in. Not a chance. This guy's in chains. He's been sold. Listen, he's been sold to the people that sell to the Egyptians. These are lower than the Egyptians. I don't know if you've ever been around a carnival midway, but there's a culture of people in that type of lifestyle that you don't like being around. They're a strange group of people, strange breed. I mean, living in a pickup truck night after night. And they're just an unusual crowd. As a matter of fact, people have written books about them. I don't know if you've ever been around any gypsies. Strange, strange people. When Brother Brad and I think were in Greece, we saw a gypsy village. And it was made out of sticks and tubifores and plastic visqueen. That's how they make their houses. Just almost a city out there. And junky, rusted out trucks. Garbage everywhere. Children running around with dirty diapers. I mean, just, you'd look at it and you think, who in the world lives like this? And yet they tell me there's as much money in a gypsy community as any city you'd come across. Brother Bailey told me about going to a gypsy wedding and watching a bride and groom. I think he said they got $28,000 in cash. Figured it up later. Counted the drachmas. $28,000. I mean, you know, you could do, it'd be a place to go to get married, young people. You got any gypsy blood in it, take advantage of it. But you look at that lifestyle, I mean, I don't think anybody would volunteer to want to go live with the gypsies. I haven't had anybody come say, preacher, you know, I got an offer for a new job and fixing to move over here in this gypsy village to live. Got me a little visqueen tent here. They're just certain groups of people, because of their cultural habits, you don't want to be around. Now, I don't mean that to sound racist. I really don't. There's certain tribes in New Guinea I'd prefer not to live around. I told you Sunday night about some of the things that they told me were in the Philippines. I don't believe I've really got a hankering to go. I want to go and preach, but I don't really want to move there. And here, these are the Midianites. That's that kind of people. Not even the Egyptians wanted these people around. These people to the Egyptians are kind of two or three rungs down on the ladder. And the Egyptians are three or four rungs down on the ladder. Remember when Abraham went down to Egypt? He doesn't have fond memories of Egypt. And here goes Joseph being drawn behind camels, chained, tethered to these camels, taken down there. Whether they're going to stop and eat him along the way for food is not at all unlikely. Remember, these are the Midianites. And while Judah was concerned with profit, these Midianites aren't. This guy could just as easily be used to feed their camels as anything else. They're not concerned at all. If they get too hungry and there's not enough food, wouldn't be unlike them to take one of his arms and roast it. Keep him alive so they got the rest of him for a later date. These are a crass, heathenistic people. Now, think with me for a minute. Joseph is hated of his brethren. And he doesn't say anything. He's sold to the Midianites. He doesn't say anything. But go one step further with me. What's Joseph been dreaming about? Joseph's dreams, have they been this way or this way? I mean, they're picking up. In his dreams, he's going to be the ruler. In his dreams, remember the sheep was there and all the other sheaves bowed down and worshipped him. And in the dream, all the stars and the sun and the moon bowed down to him. This is not what God's will appears to be for his life. You see that? Not only has God made him alone from his brethren and his family, but now God's hiding himself from Joseph. Something about being alone, God uses. You know, David said over there in the Psalms, the Lord is the portion of my inheritance. He said in another place, I lift up mine eyes into the hills, from whence cometh my help? My help cometh from the Lord. Over and over again, you'll find him talking about the Lord. And the things that he says, he learned amidst adversity. If David had not had difficulty in his life, he would not have known about God what he knows about God. It's amazing. They who sing the sweetest songs normally bear the most scars. David's life is filled with scars, filled with hurt, and yet he sings the songs of Zion. He is considered a man after God's own heart. Perhaps it's because he knew suffering. You say, well, David lived in a palace. Not always. And that palace was no guard against sin. The gate was not high enough to keep sin out. The wall was not high enough to keep sin out. And David lived in a palace, but that palace was a place where sin found its way in. Found its way to the heart of David. Loneliness. God has separated his family from it. But now God goes one step further and hides himself. You know, God likes to play hide and come seek. God likes to hide himself. He likes us to pursue him. He likes us to hunt him. He likes us to chase him down. The bridegroom, or the bride, in the Song of Solomon talks about her bridegroom knocking on the door, and when she rose up to open the door, he was gone. He'd withdrawn himself. He's hidden. She went looking for him. He likes to be pursued. You come to the Beatitudes. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Here goes Joseph down with the Midianites, the heathen's heathen, headed for the land of Egypt, where nobody wanted to be, with visions in his mind of being the leader. His brethren bowing down to him, but as he looks back, his brethren on their faces laughing in the sand. Because at last they're rid of their number one sore spot. And Joseph looks around and thinks about his dreams, and don't you know, he thought to himself, where are you, God? Where are you? Is this what you had planned for my life? Why the dream? Why the vision? Lord, why all the trouble I've been through in my life? I thought I had this dream. I had this vision. And I thought if I suffered and endured patiently, I thought... Joseph doesn't say a word. You and I would be saying something. Joseph had what I call a jovial attitude. I didn't say jovial. I said jovial. Like Job. You know what Job said? Job went through the fire. Job was not a Baptist. I know that because of the way he reacted. Job's wife said, curse God and die. Get it over with. Commit suicide. And Job could look back and see all the things behind him. And where he was bore no testimony to what he had had. You'd have looked at Job out there on the ash heap, you'd never recognize, oh, that guy used to be wealthy. That guy used to have a big family. That guy used to have it all. You looked at him, he looked like any poor slob sitting out on the ash heap. And Job, I'm sure, could look back. But you know what Job said? He said, hey, he knows the way that I take. And when I am tried, I shall come forth as gold. Job was alone. He was alone with God, and he was alone for God. Job's attitude was, God, I don't know where you are, but when this is all done, it'll be clear. All Job wanted in the course of his trials was to deal with God. Remember? His three friends came. He said, I don't need you. I need God. They said, we want to help you out. I don't want your help. I want to talk to God. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you and I had the attitude whenever anything in our life went wrong, whenever anything in our life seemed to be out of order, we wanted God and nobody else? Did you ever see a child when it was hurt? Who does it want? Mama. It wants mama. They'll stand back here and cry for mama. I watched Miss Snow's little girl the other night. I mean, it was just wall-to-wall people back here. And here she comes, you know, she's just running through the land of the forest here going, "Mama! Mama! Mama!" I didn't even bother to help her. I figured she'll find her. She's doing fine. She's on her way. Listen, when a child is hurt, it wants mama. Why? Is it because mama can take care of what's wrong? Not always. Sometimes mama can't make it any better. But that child has a desire to be with mama. There's something comforting just being in mama's presence. By the way, ladies, you need to make sure you don't give that up with your equal rights. I mean, that'd probably be up for grabs if you're not careful. But you want to tell you what it ought to be for a Christian? When a Christian is hurting, they ought not to want anybody around but Jesus Christ. There ought to be times in your life where you don't want to talk to anybody but Him. There will be times in your life where you just want to go and get away with Him and just talk to Him. There ought to be a place where you meet with Him every day. I find that the more an individual faces adversity, number one, the more they can handle the hatred of life. But number two, even when God chooses to lead them in a different path, they can take it comfortably, quietly, and peaceably. You know, we love God as long as He doesn't rock the boat. I'll bet if I said tonight, "How many of you love the Lord Jesus Christ?" Everybody raise their hand. Get that pious little holy smile on your face. You know, we love God. But I'll bet if somewhere between midnight and daybreak, your whole life turned upside down. Some of you same loving people would be cursing God and blaming it on God and accusing God. And Joseph just kept his mouth shut. He doesn't have anything to say. You know what that is? That is trust. Remember, He knoweth the way that I take. And when I'm tried, I shall come forth as gold. So Jesus kneels in the garden and says, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass. But nevertheless, not my will, but Thy will." He was willing to submit His will to the Father's will. What is that? Trust. Trust. All right. Joseph's early walk with God we've looked at tonight. We've got a lot to say about Joseph. I hope you'll be here each week as we go through more and look at the life. I enjoy, I guess, preaching and teaching about Joseph more than any character in the Bible. I don't think I've had a revival meeting in 3 or 4 years but what I didn't preach at least one time on Joseph. I believe he's wonderful. Wonderful to preach about. And you'll be here for the next probably 5 or 6, 7, 8, 10 weeks till we get through. All right, let's stand tonight.